Chapter 6. Move. When I see someone at their desk all day, it's suspicious how they pretend to work. Tom Kelly. We were born to move. Scientists have found that our ancestors moved up to 12 miles per day, every day. Why? It's perhaps fairly obvious on reflection that they moved to survive, either to hunt for food or escape from predators. I'm not sure what would be the worst ending from not moving, starving to death or being eaten alive by a saber-toothed tiger. So movement is in our DNA. It is part of the survival imperative. Yet what happens today is that we sit, all day, every day. This has garnered much attention in the medical profession in recent years. Doctors call the phenomena sitting disease. The Washington Post brought much of this research together in an alarming graphic in 2014, highlighting the effects of excessive sitting time on muscle degeneration, poor circulation, and excessive insulin production, which may result in different cancers. So given that the modern professional workplace is characterized by a distinct lack of movement, having an office job becomes one of the most dangerous professions we may pursue. Harvard Business Review picked up on this at the beginning of 2013 with the post, "Sitting is the smoking of our generation." The focus here is our lack of awareness of the dangers of a sedentary lifestyle in today's society, just like our lack of awareness of the dangers of tobacco 50 to 60 years ago. The rapid changes we have experienced as a society in terms of movement and mobility are traced in the following chapter. It is always surprising to find newspaper advertisements from the 1950s in which medical practitioners would support the sale of well-known cigarette brands. I'm sure the advice for coping with the pressures of the workplace would be much different today, because we have long known that smoking tobacco is not a wise choice for relaxing and combating stress. Yet we cannot afford any smugness. What may seem obvious with the benefit of hindsight often takes time to emerge. How might the second nature practices of future generations look? Especially considering that some studies have shown sitting disease to be so severe that it has the same effects on life expectancy as smoking. The good news is that dramatic changes to one's life are not required. We need not convert ourselves into marathon runners. Australian researchers measured the movement of office workers and then carried out a series of health checks related to their cardiovascular health, weight, and related measures. What they found was that workers who moved just a little bit more, even just a minute every hour to hour and a half, were at significantly reduced risk of health problems associated with heart disease and being overweight. So the small things can make a big difference over time. Again, sitting disease can be so powerful that even runners can be in danger of it. Even the most serious runners may run only 2 to 3 hours per day, yet the day has 24 hours, and running this amount often means minimizing movement during the remainder of the day. So the key is continual movement throughout the day. The first law of SEP. Yet because we sit all day doesn't mean we don't get tired at the end of it. The great temptation when we arrive home is to remain static, often converting ourselves into true couch potatoes. And so the sedentary lifestyle of the office environment becomes a vicious circle. Here is where I want to share the first law of SEP. When we move, we create energy. A common misconception is that physical movement spends energy. We often say or hear, "I'm tired, I need to sit down," or "I'm tired, I need a nap." At times this may be the case, but within the context of the modern professional workplace, I would suggest that when you're tired, stand up. When you're tired, go for a walk. Get outside, get some air. Because we were born to move, because movement is part of our survival imperative, when we move, we generate energy. And the path to making the change can be straightforward. The common sense benefits for the whole self of physical movement may be best illustrated by a quote from David Livingstone, the 19th century missionary and explorer. "Brisk exercise imparts elasticity to the muscles. Fresh and healthy blood circulates through the brain. The mind works well. The eye is clear. The step is firm. And the day's exertion always makes the evening's repose thoroughly enjoyable." Contemporary research, mostly within the domain of healthy aging, the battle against cognitive disease, and learning efficacy for children, seems to advance along three principal areas of brain benefit from physical movement. First, the oxygen advantage provided to the brain, providing extra energy through the transportation of blood, which also helps with repair functions. Second, the activation of the brain in terms of neuron development associated with exercise. And third, the release of hormones that help growth. The mechanisms that mediate the benefits of exercise at the cerebral level are associated with changes of neurotransmitters and neurotrophic factors. All of them contribute to improve cognitive performance and counteract the negative effects of the aging process in the brain. A further interesting benefit related to healthy aging is the concept of cognitive reserve, which refers to the protective effects against dementia and other brain disorders in older people who maintained higher levels of activity throughout their lives. Although the context for brain-body research has rarely focused on executive performance, such research lines clearly show much promise for the business professional in order to sustain performance during a long, happy, and healthy career. We now turn our attention to the workplace context, and especially the clear business benefits of moving more. Escaping sedentary traps in the workplace. So what changes could we make in the workplace to move more? Think first about the culture of work and the habits that make up your day. How do you communicate with your colleagues? Why do we email or phone someone who is on the other side of the room or separated by a couple of floors? Putting aside for one moment the stress-inducing volume of email that we receive, which we cover in Chapter 10, why don't we simply get up from our desk and go and see that person? Of course, documents may need to be shared, but often we need to communicate clear messages, and a message is often better delivered face-to-face, with no ambiguity and no misunderstandings. I came to understand the criticality of face-to-face communication in my doctoral research on virtual teams, design and creativity. Teams have been conceived as distributed if separated by as little as 50 feet. We are often changed by our built environment in ways we fail to recognise immediately, which nonetheless offers opportunities to design an environment for positive behaviour. Robert Kraut, a social psychologist at Carnegie Mellon, studied proximity and communication patterns as far back as 1990, leading to an awareness of the value of accidental encounters, where people may be indulging in general chit-chat that could lead to discovering valuable information, such as a project from another function with similar features to their own, a client request, or available technology. This became known as the water cooler effect, and companies then began to design spaces to encourage such encounters that could lead to these unexpected synergies. Today, such a dynamic results in many companies, regardless of their technology capability or prowess, such as Google, actively discouraging remote and telecommuting work. By having more of their talent physically co-located, they're convinced of more opportunities for high-quality creative work. Delivering a message face-to-face may run the risk of not finding the other person at his or her desk. You can, of course, call ahead, though the temptation is that you convey the full message via phone. However, the likelihood is that the person is part of the same sedentary sitting trap that affects most of us, and you'll find your contact there. Regardless of your destination, the accidental encounters along the way may provide you with valuable insight. I think this is the dynamic nature of work today, especially creative work, which builds on the Tom Kelly quote that opens this chapter. Taking time away from your chair and having greater visibility in the workplace also helps build personal relationships, and senior staff may benefit from spending more time using the management by walking around method, an accepted management method principally in the context of quality, where managers raise their awareness of the front line of operations through unstructured wandering. So, to beware the chair offers us many more benefits than simply combating sitting disease. But what other changes could we implement? How about just standing more? For example, during simple short tasks, as inferred by the 2012 New York Times article, "Stand up while you read this." Yet standing for longer periods may work also. Ernest Hemingway, at least when he was sober, wrote all his books while standing up. So why do we have sitting desks anyway? Standing desks have come to prominence in the last couple of years, with sophisticated solutions provided by major office furniture companies such as Steelcase, which have motor control to be able to switch between seated and standing positions. Yet hacked versions can be done for free by simply propping a laptop or computer on several stacks of paper. This is one of the major changes I have integrated in my home office. I found an inexpensive architect-style desk from IKEA and raised it to its maximum height, which was still a little low, so I propped my Oxford English Dictionary underneath my keyboard and also raised the monitor and mouse in a similar fashion. I found my own productivity and task attention to improve greatly. It also improved my posture, back and core strength, critical areas for a busy professional that we cover here and in later chapters. We also burn more calories standing, an extra 50 per hour, according to researchers at the University of Chester, the equivalent of running 10 marathons a year by standing 3 to 4 hours per day at work. Another potential advantage is less distracted time from co-workers. If colleagues have a habit of approaching your desk or entering your office and taking a seat when you want to continue with focused work, a standing desk may help to cut the time they distract you. I think it's always good to have a seating option for you to read or meet people in a relaxed fashion. If you don't invite your guests to take a seat, you may find that they begin to get twitchy by remaining standing and so leave you alone to work much sooner. To Hemingway, add Abraham Lincoln, Donald Rumsfeld and William Lever as exponents of standing while working. As we covered in the previous chapter, however, it's critical to maintain a level of awareness of any new practice, measuring, reflecting, and adjusting. At the beginning of my own standing working practice, I began with such gusto that after several months of standing for several hours a day, I began to develop a heel compression injury. This may or may not happen to you. I was training for a marathon around the same time, and so my running habits meant my heel wasn't getting sufficient recovery. The lesson was obvious for me: have a clear view on the effects of any change and implement that change step by step. Standing for an hour or two with sitting periods in between is probably better than standing all day, at least at the outset. Being on our feet all day may not be the best. Ask any waiter or bar staff. A strong business case exists for challenging the sedentary culture of the workplace, and the biggest potential benefit of them all is changing meetings. Next, I'll share one of my experiences of changing meetings and culture in small business. Hydrofit. Hydrofit Subsea was a successful small company in the energy capital of Scotland, Aberdeen. I had started consulting for them after meeting the senior manager during one of my cycle tours in Girona in 2005. Suffering up one of the cols, or mountain passes, used by Tour de France riders as part of their winter training, their conversation had turned to small business strategy and innovation. The company had experienced rapid growth and was fantastically successful on a turnover and profit level, but was not without its stresses and strains. Known for hard work and reliability, it was a trusted partner to some of the oil majors and manufacturers, such as BP, Chevron, and Vetco Gray. The energy of the three men who comprised the senior team was impressive, yet the health of the senior manager started to suffer. A back operation to address a disc hernia was only the beginning, and his increasing waistline, mixed with a pining for former athletic prowess, complicated our personal coaching and wider organisational change. I focused first on the simple matter of bottlenecks. Small and medium-sized enterprises, with about 50 people or fewer, can function well with a single line of command to the manager at the top. And so it was in this case, a very paternalistic, small company driven, yet also limited by one man. Meetings were the order of the day, every day, all day, either with the other two managers, wider company staff or clients. They were often poorly focused, with no agenda and beset by distractions of the senior manager, who was thinking on several matters at once. Decision-making and action started to slow in the company, yet the answer to a more lean, focused operation was next door in the workshop. The engineers who serviced the subsea equipment would hold frequent toolbox talks during the day. The talks were short, focused, actionable, and crucially, standing. Lean manufacturing principles were practiced in the workshop environment, and this had extended to the communication between the engineers. meeting for a maximum of 10 minutes to discuss the high priority jobs on the floor and raising potential problems to their successful completion. So why didn't we practice those same lean principles across the road in the management space? Standing meetings were then implemented in the office space, along with several other golden rules of having meetings, with copies of the following 10 steps to better meetings posted around the company. 1. Don't call a meeting unless you have to. Make sure, really sure, that the meeting is needed. 2. Invite only those people who will get something out of the meeting. Only have people come if they're going to contribute and or get something out of the meeting. 3. Cancel your meeting if you think you no longer need to have it or if everyone is not prepared. Never have a meeting just for the sake of having it. 4. Have a leader. Every meeting should have a leader who can hold everyone accountable to keeping things on track. 5. Announce at the beginning how long the meeting is going to last. Set a time limit. Then think about cutting it in half. Put a clock in plain view. If you have droners at your meetings, establish a time limit for how long any one person can talk. 6. Maintain a zero tolerance policy towards latecomers. Punish them in some good-natured way. Charge them money. Make them serve the coffee. 7. Set a crystal clear agenda and stick to it. If other issues come up, make a note of them and then get back to the agenda. 8. Ban toys. No digital devices. 9. Schedule the meeting for first thing in the morning when people are more alert and still intending to get something done that day. 10. Try holding meetings standing up. Standing meetings are shorter than sitting meetings. It was a simple change that had a good impact on a coherent company culture as well as those bottlenecks. Those back disc problems had also been a symptom of the increasing amount of sitting time in the manager's life, from his early morning 40-minute commute to work, followed by meetings all day long and a sofa crash at night. His back had become increasingly weaker over a period of time. Standing more, in addition to other back and core strengthening exercises that we implemented, helped to strengthen the back again. In the HydroFit case, health, well-being and performance from a small change and also business coaching of the senior manager helped to drive organisational change and culture. Standing meetings are a quick and easy win in a business age where meetings represent more than one third of an executive's weekly time, at least 20 hours. What percentage of that time is wasted on people playing with their electronic toys, arriving late and leaving early, or simply not listening to what is going on? The agile programming movement in the United States has been characterized by a wave of standing meetings, which helps cut down on inefficient wasted time, making meetings more focused and people more mindful. Mindfulness is a core topic of discussion in Chapter 10. People report on the current status of their job and what they're doing that day before moving on to the next person. Walking meetings could be viewed as a natural progression in this line of thought, another simple physical action with many repercussions on the performance as well as health and well-being levels. Steve Jobs was a well-known advocate of the walking meeting, believing in the value of getting to know someone on a walk and being able to drill down on a tough problem. Why indeed do we have the orthodoxy of a meeting where we often sit across from one another at a desk? It's quite an adversarial position to begin with. I've suggested walking meetings for several years now, and they tend to go well. Whether that comes from the fact that both people have the same view, or because they're simply happy to be away from their desks, I'm not sure, but they do work. Of course, there are limitations. With more than two people, they can be tricky. You don't want to look like the cast of Reservoir Dogs, or where reference to key data is required, yet management is often about critical, intimate conversations that occur frequently between pairs of people. The nuance of those critical conversations often makes the difference. Perhaps you've thought of the sensitivity of a conversation you needed to have and so have taken it out of your own office to counter any power play dynamics. Maybe you've suggested having coffee to have an informal chat or a breakfast or lunch meeting to take the pressure off. Next time, make a suggestion to go for a walk and see what happens. Another common practice is to take a conference call and go for a walk, at least fulfilling the potential of the mobile phone in the workplace. Sometimes our focus is so intently placed on the conversation, that we're not even aware or mindful of the movement and exercise, or even the route we have taken. Attention is therefore placed on the mental activity at the expense of the physical. The physical movement, fresh air and associated blood and oxygen movement, can have a powerful impact on our thinking process along with our well-being. For many years we have believed in the power of mobility for the thought process, and more generally the performance of the brain. And only now are we beginning to understand so much more on a scientific level to back up these long-held anecdotal beliefs. Brain imaging scans allow us to compare the brain activation that results from mobility as compared to sitting at our desk. Psychophysiologist Dr. Charles Hillman has shown that we essentially switch ourselves on by moving. Much of his work has been with school children in an attempt to correlate fitness with academic performance, and he has found that better fitness equals better attention and better results. Yet quality thinking, so often at a premium within a busy, distracted workplace, can also be supported. In the Harvard Business Review blog, Dan Palotta talked of his going for a walk but not calling it a break, citing his own preparation for an important assignment that required hard focus, which progressed much more rapidly during the process of walking. A recent Stanford study also found that walking improved creativity by an average of 60% as compared to sitting. For executive health, well-being and performance, walking isn't quite a panacea, but I think it's as close as one can get. As 20th century historian George Macaulay Trevelyan said, "I have two doctors, my right leg and my left." Designing our environment for health, well-being and performance. We can, of course, push back against a non-optimal workplace through simple practices, yet may we also design our workplace to better support health, well-being and performance. Another Stanford piece of research linked to the design school looked at different types of sitting and how this affected a common creativity method, that of brainstorming. Specifically, they found that the design of the chair affected people's behaviour regarding their criticism of other ideas. One of the key rules of brainstorming is that we build on the ideas of others, even the wild and unrealistic ones, because we may construct a point of departure on which a more feasible, innovative idea may result. The researchers found that when people were sitting on comfortable sofa-type chairs, resting back, they would criticise the ideas of others and the sessions wouldn't go so well. By replacing these comfortable chairs with more uncomfortable stools, with people perched on the edge, they tended to support more ideas and the brainstorming would improve. Along similar lines, the link between posture and defensiveness has been investigated by researchers at the Olin Business School. Comparing the work of groups having a table and chairs compared to having no chairs, they found that those who remained standing were less territorial, more collaborative, and more excited about their work. So simple body posture was shown to affect the quality and output of teamwork. Treadmill desks have also gained attention in recent years within the context of sedentary dangers and workplace redesign. My own view is that they could be an option depending on the context of work. For example, in call centres where people are required to be at their own workstation responding to external clients 100% of their time. I don't think, however, they should constitute the go-to option on a general level. Where is the credibility for managers conducting an indoor walking treadmill meeting? There are simple means of improving health, well-being and performance in move and the remaining SEP elements in which your professional conduct is maintained, even improved. Treadmill desks, in my view, don't always fit within that professional conduct. Make movement a more natural, accidental concept and build a dynamic culture where we are not chained to our desk. The topic of stretching is also considered within a reflection on workplace movement and professional conduct. Movement in terms of walking and the number of steps we take in a day is a primary consideration together with the time we spend sitting. Thinking about stretching and posture, particularly during seated periods in the workplace, is also important. Yet this doesn't mean we ought to start an aerobic session in the office. Subtle, small body movements and good practice can make a big difference. I believe the world of dance to offer the best lessons. As I mentioned in Chapter 4, My wife trained as a dancer, and I've spent a lot of time with dancers over the years. Putting aside their strength for a moment, ballet dancers, for example, are arguably the strongest athletes in the world. I believe there to be two main lifelong takeaways of dance training. The first is related to discipline, respect, and good manners, and the second to posture. Dancers know how to carry themselves, how to stand tall, how to sit, and when and how to stretch. For example, moving one's head from side to side and up and down can help to alleviate tension. Our heads weigh up to 5 kilograms in weight, and if we don't move it all day, tension can build in the neck, shoulders, and elsewhere. Rolling the shoulders or extending the arms backward are simple movements that can provide benefit during a long day and need not draw attention in an open workspace environment. Finding a private space to conduct more of the floor exercises to help back pain and core strength is a worthwhile pursuit that only requires 5 minutes practice a day to gain real value. The wider context and implications of our built environment are discussed in the next chapter, but first we'll consider another simple aspect on the architectural level, stair use. Volkswagen created a popular series of fun theory video shorts a few years ago. One of those was piano stairs, where they built a piano on a set of subway stairs in Stockholm, resulting in a 66% increase in people taking the stairs instead of the escalator. This case highlights the barriers and attitude towards movement in society and the fact that we have engineered movement out of our lives. We've been too clever, designing machines that allow us to minimise movement to the detriment of our health and ultimately performance. Subway stairs are a common example in research related to improving citizen health, and building design may be another. Why should the elevator be the first thing that we see when entering a building instead of the staircase? Even finding the staircase in many modern day buildings, and especially hotels, think of your business travels, is a tough task. An opportunity for movement and the associated benefits of heart health and weight management is missed, and we waste time waiting. Even using the stairs is not permitted in certain companies that are afraid of accidents in the stairway. This is health and safety with a narrow, short-term view. Lack of movement in society can also be linked to advancement, as we discuss in the following chapter. With increased status in an organisation, we often enjoy the services of a chauffeur or are given a reserved parking space. Again, challenge conventional orthodoxy and do yourself a favour by parking in a spot farthest away from the entrance. This extra daily movement will be beneficial, especially if you have sedentary traps in other areas of your life. So we have engineered movement out of our lives because we view it as an inconvenience. Yeah, I hope to have made the case so far in this chapter that it is rather an opportunity for improving health, well-being, and performance. Always taking the stairs may be considered trite and insignificant, but it can have a large impact on weight management. It may also create an important mental break. For example, in a busy day going from meeting to meeting, where stress levels increase during the email-focused elevator rides that serve as the only break between those meetings. We look in detail at habit forming and behaviour change in Chapter 16, and even the simple change of taking the stairs can be a challenge, made easier by taking the right approach. So look for opportunities to move more in a busy professional life, understanding that movement creates energy, even when those opportunities are not entirely obvious. Let me give you an example. I teach 3 to 4 times a year in China, and given that I live in Barcelona, it's a long trip. I normally have a stopover in Dubai. Flying from Barcelona to Dubai takes around 7 hours, after which I have a short 2-hour layover before flying the 9 hours or so to Shanghai. Of course, during the flights, I'm mostly immobile. I'm seated or sleeping, and I can't move so much. What I started to do the past few years during that 2-hour layover in Dubai is look for opportunities to move. Even on those flat, moving sidewalks and escalators, I keep moving, which often requires gently nudging aside half-asleep travellers. During those 2 hours, I walk, and I walk. I take advantage of any opportunity to move during that time. I felt my energy increase and also make my body truly tired for the next flight, on which I attempt to sleep. When I get to my destination, I found my jet lag to be greatly decreased. Let's think about jet lag. On a layover, people often rush to find an opportunity to sit down or sleep. Yet we've just been sitting or sleeping for hours during the previous flight, and we'll probably do so again on the next one. We may have a desire to eat and drink, yet we've just been eating and drinking for several hours on the preceding flight, and we'll do so again. We get to our destination and say, jet lag's killing me. This isn't jet lag, it's a hangover. There will always be a degree of jet lag due to a misalignment of our circadian rhythm. We discuss this and other tips for minimising jet lag in the next SEP element, Recover, in Chapter 8. But we can also impact greatly on its effects through small changes. Hydrating well, paying attention to food and drink, and most of all, moving at every opportunity. In addition to the wider barriers to movement in our society, the Volkswagen Fun Theory video also shows a possible means by which we can get people to change. In effect, the piano stairs acted as a nudge, a gentle push to make people change their behaviour. The 66% more people who took the stairs were most likely unaware that they were doing so, their attention instead taken with the fun of the piano simulation. Yet such a simple practice may have become a habit in the long run. There are different ways of designing environments to nudge people toward different behaviour. A UK government department is nicknamed the Nudge Department, given its focus on people's behaviour related to environmental recycling and other areas of government interest. I have tried to create similar nudges to that of the piano stairs in subtler, low-budget ways through signage, which again challenges conventional orthodoxy. Why should we wait for an emergency, for example, before taking the stairs? It helps to put a question mark on long-held practices from time to time. It's worth repeating, taking the stairs whenever possible, often viewed as a trite, insignificant action, may have a powerful impact on your life. Top 10 takeaways. Move. 1. Movement is part of our DNA. Our ancestors moved to survive. 2. Beware the chair. Our current society is characterized by a lack of movement and excessive sitting time, which is putting in peril our survival. 3. Movement creates energy. In the oxygen-rich blood that is transported through the body and brain, activating neurons and releasing hormones conducive to better cognitive performance. 4. Get away from your desk for more direct communication and the accidental encounters that drive innovation. 5. Stand for longer during individual work to improve focus, productivity, and core strength. 6. Conduct standing meetings for improved focus, more collaborative teamwork, and less wasted time. 7. Conduct walking meetings to build relationships and cover sensitive subjects. 8. Go for a walk to tackle tough problems and advance quality work. 9. Maintain your professional conduct and change practices to allow the best chances of changing the company culture. 10. Push back against societal norms that look to minimise movement, stand out from the crowd, and thereby nudge others to follow your lead. Measurement, as we traced fully in the previous chapter, can be another powerful nudge. So what can you measure for movement? What changes will you attempt to implement? And do you have a clear view on the effects of those changes? Scientists found that our ancestors moved up to 12 miles per day, incidentally, the same distance that Jagger moves in one concert. We may not have to move that distance to find food or escape from predators, but finding out the distance and the practices that form the basis of that distance for your own health, well-being, and performance imperative can lead to life transformation.